Last week, a number of you asked me to recommend some resources that you could use with sharing with Muslims. And this is a book you can get from Reasons to Believe. We still have a few copies left. But in my opinion, it's the best work done that contrasts Christianity with Islam, the Bible with the Quran. And it's this book, The Quran and the Bible in the Light of History and Science. And it's written by Dr. William Campbell. And William Campbell is a medical researcher who spent most of his life ministering in North Africa. And Africa is a place where a book by Maurice Bucaille called The Quran and the Bible has been widely distributed. He's an Islamic apologist. And basically he wrote a book, and there's millions of copies around the world have been distributed, trying to make the claim that the Bible is filled with scientific errors and the Quran is quite the opposite. It's scientific perfection, and talks about the Quran made such amazing predictions that people would walk on the moon. And what William Campbell does is show, number one, that Maurice Bucaille is using a straw man argument. He basically adopts the young earth interpretation of the Bible and shows how science has refuted that, and tries to imply that if you're a Christian, you're a young earth creationist. Well, this class, I think, is living proof that that's not true. So, and for centuries, that's not been true. It was certainly not true of people who lived centuries ago. But then William Campbell goes on to really dig into the Quran, shows how it's filled with internal contradictions. That's not the case with the Bible. And just documents all the historical and scientific errors there that most Muslims have never been exposed to. Kind of tongue-in-cheek, he makes the point that it must have been written by a man, not by a woman, because it gets the gestation period for human females wrong, 6 months as opposed to 9 months. But then it really talks about the creation accounts in the Quran and how they contradict one another. And the problem is most Muslims have never really looked at these in any way to compare them. And you know, even things about, you know, contrast things like how the Bible talks about how the mountains shake, and talks about plate tectonic activity, volcanoes and earthquakes. But if you look at the Quran, it tells us that the mountains are pillars that force the earth not to move at all. And so, you know, modern geology tells us it's the mountainous region where you're most likely to experience earthquakes. The Quran says the opposite, that it's the mountains where things are going to be rock steady. Well, all of us living here in the L.A. Basin, I think, are quite aware that that's not the case. Anyway, it's well documented. I also like the tone of the book. It's written in such a way that you can give it to a Muslim, and I don't think a Muslim is going to be immediately offended, because as they read through this, they're going to say, gee, I never knew this. I mean, it really is an eye-opener for people in the Islamic faith. So, yeah, this is the book I would recommend if you're wanting to, you know, share with Muslims and about the difference between the Bible and the Quran. And the thing that I appreciate about William Campbell, he says, your typical Muslim has never read one page of the Bible. And says, in his experience in reaching out to Muslims is, if they will only expose themselves to a few chapters of the Bible, that's usually all it takes. Because right away they see the dramatic difference between the way the Bible is written and the way the Quran is written. This is the big challenge, is to get them to read even a few chapters of the Bible. Yes?
Isn't Muhammad, when he was writing the Quran, he incorporated thousands of phrases from the Bible?
Yeah, that's what William Campbell documents, is that you will find about 26,000 words that are taken from the Bible word for word. He doesn't use the word plagiarism, but that's exactly what it is. I mean, on the other hand, Muslims will say, no problem with that, because they say, we believe that the Old and New Testament are inspired works of Allah. The problem is they don't encourage their people to read the Old and New Testament. So, but that's one approach that William Campbell says, is their own book, the Quran, states that the Old and New Testament are inspired writings, and therefore you can use that as a means to encourage them to say, hey, if you want the full revelation of God, and you need to look at the Old and New Testament, not just the Quran. And when they do that, they'll see the difference.
But they'll claim we changed it since the first century.
Well, that's a major debate. And he actually goes into that, because Muslims will say that there is no reliable manuscript history for the Bible, the truth is there is virtually a zero manuscript history for the Quran. I mean, there's no way you can trace it back to Muhammad. You can't even trace it back to 3 centuries after Muhammad. And so in the case of the Bible, you've got intact manuscripts that date back at least portions to the first century, and complete New Testaments that date back to the 3rd and 4th century A.D. So very strong manuscript evidence for the Bible. But of course, what William Campbell is pointing out is the Muslims have been taught that there's no manuscript evidence for the Bible, but they've never checked it out for themselves. And the fact is, you can see the manuscripts in the British Museum. They're out there for public display. It says these days they can go on the web and they can actually see the manuscript evidence for the Bible. And you can ask them, well, where's the manuscript evidence for the Quran? It just doesn't exist. Okay, anyway, one question here.
The Bible was written by the influence and the inspiration of the Holy Spirit to the apostles and to
the prophets.
My question is that how and when was the Quran written? Under what influence?
Well, Muhammad lived in the 8th century, 7th and 8th century A.D., but the earliest manuscripts you have for the Quran are coming in about 300 years later. And even in the Quranic theological system, they claim that Muhammad did not write the Bible. He verbally communicated it, and later disciples took what they had memorized and put it down in writing. But of course, there's no evidence that this was being memorized word for word. That's one reason why you have Muslims today encouraging the total memorization of the Quran, because it supports their doctrine that the Quran was preserved through memorization for centuries before it took written form.
From what source? I mean, where does that influence come from? Because like in John, I think it talks about how you're supposed to test the spirits, and Paul mentioned the Colossians for his friends.
Right.
Except with philosophers, because there's ministering spirits that are deceptive.
Well, that's William Campbell's point, is that you cannot come up with any evidence for the claimed preservation of the Quranic text through memorization. That's a modern phenomenon. We don't see evidence that goes back to the time. And so the Islamic claims that this is the actual words of Muhammad can't be documented by any evidence.
This might sound like a kooky question, but as Lucifer or Satan masquerades as an angel of light, could he be making himself manifest in that deceptive way in order to trick?
Well, something that William Campbell brings out is the New Testament does warn us that there would be Christs and prophets that would follow after Jesus, and therefore were to test the spirits to see if they're really of God or maybe they're of the evil one. And one of the things I've done with a lot of Muslims is say, there's more than one religion that takes the Old and New Testament and adds a latter-day revelation inspired by a latter-day prophet, namely Mormonism. And maybe you better check out the claims of Mormonism before you become convinced of the claims of Muhammad. And what you'll do when you do that, the Muslim's going to discover how similar their book and their theology is to the Mormon faith. By the way, it works the other way around. When I talk to Mormons, I like to say, well, have you ever checked out Islam? And because, if it is coming from the same source, namely from satanic inspiration, we should expect similarities. And what's interesting about the Islamic faith and the Mormon faith is how close their doctrine of women are. Both faiths demean women. And both faiths have a distorted view of what heaven is like. It's basically an earthly heaven with earthly pleasures. You see that in both faiths. So there's slight distinctions, and both of them are founded on a doctrine of works. Both of them fail to give any promise of eternal security. So those are kind of the common elements. They both deny the Trinity. So in that sense, let's see, if people have only heard one thing, of all they've been exposed to is the Quran and the Islamic faith, they've never checked out the Old and New Testament, they've never checked out competing faiths, then they simply won't know this. And so that's what William Campbell tries to do, is just actually try to make a scholarly comparison between the Bible and the Quran. A couple more questions, but you know what? I've got more things I want to talk about, but
okay,
this is meant just to be an announcement.
Muhammad supposedly heard from a creature named Gabriel that gave him a lot of bum dope on Jesus not being the Son of God. And also, when he was with his first wife, he complained about that he thought maybe some of his revelation was from hell. And he had a couple of years of problems of trying to figure out what was happening to him.
So, well, that's another similarity you see with Mormonism. I mean, Joseph Smith had a visit from an angel. And then you've got Muhammad having a visit from an angel. But the Bible warns us that Satan will appear as an angel of light to deceive. Therefore, we're to put these things to the test. So, and in both Mormonism and Islam, you've got the appeal to subjective testing as opposed to objective testing. That's what's distinct about the Christian faith, is the appeal to use objective testing. I'll take one more comment, and then I want to get on to another subject. Yes?
I just thought it simplified it originally. According to the Hadiths, which are considered authoritative, it's about 20,000 pages of Muhammad, he first was concerned that he was possessed by a jinn, an evil spirit. And then later, he had these apparently epileptic fits where he'd go on the ground and shake and salivate, and they'd throw blankets over him because it was so embarrassing. And then he would afterwards recover and then make these statements. People would write them down, or sometimes people would write them down, little scraps of wood or bone or palm leaf. And then something like 200 years later, a scholar collected a lot of this stuff and then put it in order of length of the same. So there's no chronology, no context, and it's just all a big jumble, and that's according to their own tradition. I mean, that's
well, I'll tell you what hit me the first time I read the Quran was how repetitious it was, and how it was written in a language that was intended to sound holy. I kind of saw that in the Mormon text too, is that, you know, it uses a King James type English and it uses all these repeated phrases, and it's like it's trying to impress you with how spiritual it is. And that kind of hit me as a 17-year-old as kind of phony, that there'd be this such a strained attempt to make it sound spiritual. But the repetition particularly concerned me, and the fact that it wasn't very content rich. Meaning, to me, it was kind of a vacuous book, just kept repeating the same things over and over again, and things that were already stated, say, in the Old and New Testament. And when I finally did pick up the Bible, what I noticed was a warning against repetitious prayers, that were not to... says, you know, the Gentiles or the pagans pray to God with repetition, and we're to avoid that. Well, it's interesting, you pick up the Hindu Vedas, when you pick up the Quran, when you pick up the Mormon text, you see that signature of vain repetition. Anyway, let me move on. You know, a big announcement this week is a significant advance in what's called the Exoplanet Encyclopedia. That's a website that's maintained by the French astronomer Jean Schneider of the Paris Observatory. He started this back in 1995 when they discovered the first planets outside of our solar system, and he's been faithfully maintaining this catalog. Now, it was just this past Friday that I got to speak to the Orange County Astronomers Club, thanks to Tim here. He set that up. And wow, it was about 150 people that came to that. And I was impressed with just how active a club the Astronomy Orange County Astronomy Club is. They got all these special interest groups. They have meetings where they study astrophysics, meetings where they show you how to set up your telescope, and star parties. And I said, wow, this is a group that's going to know a lot about astronomy. But what was interesting was when I gave my talk and looked out at the audience, I don't know what your impression was, Tim, but as I was speaking, I was looking out at the faces and saying, these are people that have never heard this content before.
That was exactly why I invited you.
Yeah. I mean, here are these people going to astronomy clubs, you know, month after month, listening to lectures on astrophysics, hearing talks from, you know, leading astronomers in the area, and yet I had a distinct impression that what they were hearing from me about astronomy was something they'd never heard before. And what I was told later is I was the first Christian astronomer to ever address the group. So that may have had something to do with it. But I was also impressed with just the variety of theological perspectives that were there. I mean, we had very militant atheists there. We had Christians there, young earth creationists, theistic evolutionists. They were all over the place, and they were very eager in asking their questions. So it was one of the more lively events I've ever done. So, and then the discussion afterwards was great, and I sure appreciate Tim helping our volunteers at the book table, because there's a lot of debate going on there too. And Tim, if you've got some additional comments to make, I'll give you the floor for a minute or two.
I actually do.
Okay, well, come up here.
I'm glad to share that. I think I have to get a little background on this. This Orange County Astronomers is a very large club.
Orange County Astronomers is a very large club, been around for 45 years. There's something like 700 to 800 members total. There were about 165 people in the attendance of the auditorium, which is a typical size for a monthly meeting. I'm a charter member of the club. I've been around as long as anybody. I'm the only active charter member. I'm also very well recognized within the club and have a brand name, as a celebrity, because I worked so many years at JPL on the Voyager mission, and people know that and sort of have identified me as such. And so in inviting Hugh and knowing the tenor of what people felt at the club, within the club, I made a very strong statement in my introduction to him about, putting my own brand name on Hugh's background there is through this class that I've been attending for some time, and sort of trying to get it started to say, listen to this, you guys. It's not as strange as you might want to think. Don't pass it off, unnecessarily. There were a couple of things that happened at the beginning that I think set sort of a bad tone, and so it got off kind of a rocky start, but. I think Hugh did a wonderful job at covering a huge amount of information. The only problem was he tried to cover all this material, couldn't cover it in detail. This is a very detail-oriented group, and so a lot of what he said did kind of pass over their head because they didn't have the opportunity to spend all the time in here for that. After the lecture was over, since people know me well, they were had no problem coming to me, the people who had negative responses, and just kind of pounding me into the floor and saying, "What did you bring this guy for?" But there were a few positive comments. People say, "Yeah, that was a good counterpoint to what we normally have here." I see some long-term, possible opportunities for this. One is just kind of the sensitization of people to that these ideas, and the other one is kind of maybe something that could work into discussions with me, knowing how I feel about this and that I'm on this side of things. People may start coming to me with questions, so it's sort of a ministry opportunity for me possibly in the future. In fact, next weekend I'm going to be off on my annual 1-week-long stargazing and camping trip up by the Bristlecone Pines in the White Mountains east of Bishop. And three of the people who are at the lecture will be with me for parts of that time. And I'm sure we'll engender some discussion among people with us. One of these guys is a very much, earthly person, me, it's all about me kind of thing. Another guy is a former or non-practicing Mormon, and the third guy is a Christian. So we should be an interesting group. I'll need to appreciate some prayer on how to handle that. But I got really, in general, kind of a cold reception afterwards for, this is so far out, we don't know how to respond to you, that sort of thing. So I expect even at future meetings and whatnot, there will be people kind of coming back to me with their responses to that, which is going to be both directions.
Yeah. Did you get any folks that want to come to this paradoxes meeting?
No, I didn't really focus it on that.
I did.
Closely. Okay.
How many?
He may have gotten the negative reaction. I got more of the positive, especially from the women. And this one gal came up to me and said, you know, my husband keeps dragging me to these meetings. I'm not really into astronomy, and, you know, I've been bored just going to these meetings, but it says, tonight I wasn't bored. It says, I was really on the edge of my seat the whole time. So I got the impression that it was mainly a positive reception, but you know, there was definitely a polarization in the audience. Some people were quite angry that we were bringing God into the picture. Even though I started off my talk by saying, here's some leading atheist astronomers who say God is part of the picture, and we can't avoid that. You know, because of what astronomy has done, we can now actually observe the cosmic creation event, which automatically makes us theological. So I tried to use that as kind of a platform to say, you know what, this is already on the table. Why should we avoid the obvious? And let's talk about the obvious. But it was clear to me that for a lot of people in the audience, they had never really saw any possible connection between God and astronomy. And obviously some of them were fairly committed atheists that were quite disturbed about the idea that there might be a God and authority over their lives. In fact, the two that tried to pick a fight with me, that was their main issue. You mean to tell me there's somebody that can tell me what I need to do? And so it's the whole idea of autonomy. They wanted to be the boss of their own life. And that's something the Bible tells us. You will get a reaction from people who don't want anybody telling them how they should run their own lives. So, but you know, what was interesting for me is literally just days before I was scheduled to give that talk, there was a significant addition to this exoplanet encyclopedia. I mean, if you were to go to the website, that's all you got to do is put in exoplanet encyclopedia to a search engine, it pops up. And by the way, as I told the audience on Friday night, because I knew there were a lot of non-astronomers in the audience, it says you don't have to be an astronomer to discern what's going on in this encyclopedia. There's really nothing technical in the encyclopedia at all. All John Schneider does is he lists the characteristics of the planets that have been discovered outside of our solar system. And you know, a few days ago, the list was down in the 500s. It's now up to 684. So they literally added more than 100 planets in just 1 week. And you say, how come they added so many? Well, what's been happening is the Kepler satellite has been using the transit method. And you know, months ago, they announced what they called the discovery of 1,200 candidate planets. Now, a candidate planet means that maybe you got a detection. And if you look at the Kepler data, there's no indication of the mass of the planet or any of the orbital characteristics. And what I appreciate about John Schneider, he will not put a planet in its catalog unless they at least have a measurement of the mass and the distance of the star from the planet. He says, you know, I'm not going to put anything in here where we don't have any measurable data. But as of a couple of days ago, the list is now at 684 planets outside of our solar system where we know the mass of the planet, the shape of the orbit, and the distance that the planet has relative to its star, and where we also have some knowledge of the characteristics of the star. And so this is meaningful data that you can use to test different theological perspectives. That's kind of what I presented to the Astronomy Club. It says, you know, there's great excitement because they were making announcements that they were finding Earth twins and Jupiter twins. Well, what's happened in the last, oh, say, month is that two of the claims for an Earth twin have now been shown to be a mistake of measurement. So there was a lot of excitement, for example, about Gliese 581G, and two research papers have been published saying this is a non-detection. And yes, it looked like it had characteristics very close to that of the Earth. In fact, Stephen Vogt, the discoverer of 581G, supposed discoverer, said, this planet is so much like the Earth, it's guaranteed to have life on it. Well, all he had really done is demonstrate the possibility that it might have liquid water on its surface. And the reason why he said it's guaranteed that it's going to have life is the fact that we observe, I've talked about this in the class before, how when you look at planet Earth, the moment conditions reach the situation where you can have liquid water and solid rocks, you immediately have life. This is what's caused astrobiologists to say, if you ever got solid rocks and water, you're going to have life, because that's what happened on the Earth. But as I just shared here, I think it was 3 weeks ago, a research paper published by three astronomers who made the point, wait a minute, there's one other issue with planet Earth. We're living on a planet where we got humans that can observe the fact that life shows up immediately after you got water and rocks. And what they pointed out in their paper is that's the only way you can have the possibility of advanced life, if the first life shows up immediately. Because if it doesn't show up immediately, you're never going to get advanced life. So it says the fact that we live on a planet that has advanced life forces the origin of life to be immediate, and therefore they said the probability is close to zero, not one. And therefore, by the way, Stephen Vogt has at least to some degree repented of the statement that if you got water, you're going to have life. But what has happened in the meantime is a couple of these Earth-like planets have been declared non-existent. But one this week was added to the list, and it's a planet with the name HD88512. That's the name of the star. The star is always called A. The planet's called B, C, D, and E. And this was announced with great fanfare to be the discovery of another planet in what's called the Goldilocks zone, where you can have liquid water. Now then, we jumped on this the very moment it was announced. In fact, if you go on our website and check out our Science News Flash, you'll see that I did a podcast on this announced discovery literally hours after it was made. And by the way, you can now get our podcast through your iPhone. You don't need a computer. You can download free of charge what's called the Reasons to Believe app, RTB app. Go to any app store. You can get it for free. And what that does is it gives you access to all of our podcasts. You get access to a lot of our Today's New Reasons to Believe articles, our events, all kinds of stuff are there that you can just get right on your phone. So you can check that out. But I'll give you just a quick summary of what I said about HD88512. It orbits a planet, a star, that's quite a bit brighter than our sun and quite a bit younger than our sun. And that alone would rule out the possibility of life existing on HD88512b. Also, it orbits the planet at one quarter the distance of the Earth relative to the sun. And they put that in context. Mercury, the hot planet of our solar system, orbits the sun at 39% the distance that the Earth does. This one's at 26% of the distance, so it's really hot. It's also tidally locked, which means that you're going to have one face of the planet always facing the star, kind of like the way our moon is tidally locked to the Earth. We only see one face, which means it's going to be blistering hot on one side of the planet and close to absolute zero on the opposite side of the planet. The other thing we note is that it has a mass, a minimum mass, of 3.6 times that of the Earth. So it's considerably more massive than the Earth. And as the researchers who claimed this was a Goldilocks planet said, it will be a Goldilocks planet, which means it has a possibility of having liquid water on surface, if it has highly reflective clouds that cover 50% of the surface. Now, that makes it a long shot right there. But the other thing that really makes it a long shot, as I said, and also if it has an atmosphere as thin as the Earth does. Well, the principle in planetary formation is the more massive the planet, the thicker the atmosphere. And it goes up geometrically, not linearly. So, for example, you have Mercury with virtually no atmosphere. You've got the Mars, which is, 11% the mass of the Earth, that has an atmosphere as 1/16 density of the Earth. And then you've got Venus, which comes in at 40 times as massive as the Earth's atmosphere, and yet it's less massive. And by the way, Venus is the norm. Earth is the exception. Earth, according to our planetary formation model, should have an atmosphere 100 times denser than what we have. The reason why its atmosphere is so thin is because of a moon-forming collision event that happened when the Earth was about 30 to 40 million years old, and secondarily because of the late heavy bombardment. And so because of those two events, we lost 99% of the atmosphere. Now, what makes it particularly amazing is that this event happened without destroying the Earth. And it happened without destroying the Earth because the Earth at that time had an extremely deep ocean. And it was the depth of the ocean and the fact that the collider that hit the Earth at a very low velocity and at a high attack angle, that the Earth wasn't destroyed by the event. And the byproduct was Earth lost almost all of its water and almost all of its atmosphere. Well, it's that thin atmosphere and the size of our planet that makes advanced life possible on our planet. I mean, you could say, well, couldn't God go with a smaller planet and therefore with a thin atmosphere? Life's not possible if you go with a smaller planet. A smaller planet is going to gravitationally lose its water. So you need a planet of the minimum mass of the Earth just to retain the water, but that planet's got to have a thin atmosphere. And my big problem with calling this a Goldilocks planet is, given that it's 3.6 minimum times the mass of the Earth, it's bound to have a very thick atmosphere. And with a very thick atmosphere, it's no longer going to be in the zone where you're going to have liquid water on its surface. And because it's tidally locked, you're only going to have one zone anyway where the temperature is going to be appropriate. And incidentally, the Goldilocks planets that have been talked about are tidally locked planets. And the presumption is, well, if we can just simply get to the twilight zone,
right. That's
where the temperature will be just right. But the fallacy is this. Any tidally locked planet will wobble. Like if you look at the moon night after night after night, you'll notice that you're going to see about 59% of its face, not 50%, but 59%. It's because the tidal locking gets jiggled a bit because it's not just a simple two-body problem. You got the sun, you got the Earth, you got the moon, and you got Jupiter and Saturn out there, and the interaction of all these bodies causes a wobble in the tidal locking. And therefore, if you got this narrow shadow zone where the temperature is just right, guess what? It's going to be moving as the planet has that wobble in its tidal locking, which means there's nowhere on the surface of a tidally locked planet where you're going to have stable liquid water. And so, bottom line, what you'll hear in the podcast, if you get it down on one of your phones, is that this is not a Goldilocks planet. We have yet to discover a Goldilocks planet. The other one is Gliese 581d. So there's two planets that are labeled Goldilocks planets, but both of them are tidally locked, and both of them would have heavy atmospheres, which would make them non-candidates for liquid water. Now, having said that, I am predicting that when this list hits 10,000 plus, we will have Goldilocks planets. And technology is coming where we're going to be able to find thousands of Earth-sized planets. So that will happen. And that's simply an artifact of the, a byproduct of the fact that water is the second most abundant molecule in the universe. I mean, all you need to do is look at our own solar system. Two of the moons of Jupiter are more than 35% water. If you get it cold enough, you're going to have lots of water. The marvel of planet Earth is that it's extremely water poor, only 0.02 to 0.03% water, when our models predict that it should be 10 to 50% water. And incidentally, those planets that are close to the size of the Earth, the smallest planets that have been discovered in this catalog, where we got transit data, where they come in front of their star, and therefore we can actually look at the atmosphere of the planet, in every single case, the atmosphere is very thick and the water content is very high. You'll find a Today's New Reason to Believe on your RTB app, where I've written a couple of articles on the water content of these extrasolar Earth-like planets. And we're looking at about 500 times the water content that's manifested on the Earth. And the problem with that much water, you'll never get continents. And if you don't have continents on the surface together with the oceans, there's nothing to recycle the nutrients, which means you might have bacteria for a few months on the planet, but you're not going to have bacteria for millions or billions of years. and you're certainly not going to have advanced life. And that, and the whole bottom line is, finding a Goldilocks planet does not mean you've got a candidate for life. Water is only one of several hundred requirements that life demands in order to survive. And water, again, is very abundant throughout the universe. In fact, what I've been sharing with NASA scientists is their mantra is, chase the water, chase the carbon. And what I'm appealing to them is you need to do the opposite. You need to look for planets with minimal carbon and minimal water. Earth has 1,200 times less carbon than what models predict. And we have 500 times less water than what models predict. But that's exactly what you need for advanced life. Yes, life is carbon-based, but too much carbon means you're going to have an atmosphere which makes the operation of lungs impossible. Okay. Let me just follow this up a little bit before I take questions. Because the other excitement that's been coming, that came out this week, is the fact that they have announced the discovery of a Jupiter twin. Now, Jupiter is critical for allowing life to exist on the Earth. Because without Jupiter, we're going to be bombarded by way too many asteroids and comets. I mean, you know, having a 1 mile diameter asteroid hit the LA basin every few months is not a good situation. So you really need to minimize those collisions. And it's the gravity of Jupiter that prevents us from getting hit by all these asteroids and comets. And actually, it's not just Jupiter. Saturn plays a role, and so does Neptune and Uranus. In fact, it's the complex interaction of these four gas giants, where the closest one is the biggest, the second biggest is the next closest, so then you've got two that are more distant, that gives you the most efficient shield to protect our planet from taking asteroid and comet hits. You really can't design a better system than the four gas giants we see in our solar system. Now, if Jupiter were slightly more massive, its own gravity would disturb the orbit of the Earth. But if it was less massive, it wouldn't provide an adequate gravitational shield. And this is why there's been a lot of research effort on trying to see if we got a Jupiter twin. Because you're not going to have life unless you find a planetary system that is a star just like the Sun, a planet just like Jupiter, and a planet just like the Earth. That's kind of the minimum of what you're going to need. And so, yes, there's been a lot of attempts to try to find a Jupiter twin, and they've announced one. This is it. Here's Jupiter. It comes in at one Jupiter mass, of course. Its distance from the Sun is 5.2 times the distance of the Earth from the Sun, and E represents the eccentricity, which is a departure from a circular orbit. Namely, you know, all planets have elliptical orbits, that E describes how elliptical it is. Well, the Jupiter twin that got announced is Upsilon Andromeda E. E means that it's the fourth discovered planet in that system. So this is a star that has four planets in its system. And notice that the mass is quite close to that of Jupiter, 1.06 plus. Now, the plus is there because it's 1.06 if we're looking at the system perfectly in the line of sight. But if there's a tilt of the planetary plane relative to ours, then it could be a lot more than 1.06. In fact, it can go all the way up to infinity. So it's a minimum mass of 1.06. But notice that its distance from its star is 5.25 astronomical units. And it's got a very close to circular orbit. So this is, quote, a nice twin. And therefore, it's generated some excitement. Now, all you need is for the mass to go a little bit above 1.06, and this becomes a problem for life in that planetary system. But it's already a problem because of the star. The star is quite a bit dimmer than the Sun. And so this quality, the characteristics of the star itself would rule out the possibility of life in that system. But what astronomers have noted is it's ruled out by the companion planets. In addition to the E planet, you've got the C planet, which comes in at 14.5 plus times the mass of Jupiter. A planet that massive is just going to rule out any possibility born Earth-like planet with the capacity to support life, because the gravity exerted by that planet is going to be devastating. Well, of course, and also notice it's orbiting at 86% of the distance that the Earth orbits the Sun. So this is a planet that's going to be so close to the, quote, possible life support planet, and so very massive. And look at the orbit. Its eccentricity is 0.24. And so this is just going to be devastating to any Earth-like planet in the same system, as would be the characteristics of the D planet, which comes in at more than 10 times the mass of Jupiter, and it's orbiting out at just 2.5 times the distance of Earth from the Sun. And by the way, that's 0.274. That's a typo. You can't get an orbit bigger than one. Well, you could, but then that would be a parabolic or a hyperbolic orbit. Wouldn't be orbiting a star. That's 0.274. So, by the way, I got the characteristics of the star wrong. It's actually a double star. There's two stars in the system, not just one. And the main star is 28% more massive than the Sun, which makes it 340% more luminous than the Sun. Because, the luminosity of a star goes up with a fourth power of the mass of the star, and it's a young star, 3.3 billion years. And then you got an M-type star orbiting in the same system. So everything about this system tells us a non-candidate. And when people call this a Jupiter twin, the thing that they were missing is one of the key characteristics of Jupiter: it's the most massive planet in the system. So that alone rules us out as a Jupiter twin. And that is a key requirement for life, is that the Jupiter twin must be the most massive planet in the system and must be the one that's closest to its star. So in those two counts, that automatically rules us out as a Jupiter twin, which is why I put the zero over here in the chart. We still have zero twins of any of the planets in our solar system. Not only have we been unable to find an Earth-like twin, we've been unable to find a twin of any of the planets in our solar system. No Saturn twins, no Uranus twins, no Neptune twins, no Jupiter twins, and no Earth twins. And by the way, no Sun twins either. Of all the stars that we've been looking at that have planets orbiting about, none of them are twins of the Sun. So in this case, we're concluding that everything about the solar system shows that it's unique. Now, that was a key prediction of those people who were persuaded that you don't need God for life, as then we start finding these planets outside of our solar system. Many of them would prove to be twins of our solar system planets. And it's been quite shocking to the astrobiological community to discover that's not the case. In fact, as this list grows longer and longer, we're seeing that the twins on the other side all state to be zero. And of course, we got zero twins of the moon, but we can only measure moons in our own solar system. I don't think there's any hope of finding moons outside of our solar system, at least not in the immediate future. But our moon literally sticks out like a sore thumb. Our moon, in terms of its mass compared to the mass of its planet, is 50 times bigger than any other moon in our solar system. And it's 50 times bigger because it's not a true moon. When we look at the other moons in our solar system, they're either moons that formed with the planet or they're asteroids that were captured by the gravity of the planet. The moon that orbits the Earth did not come about by either of those two pathways. It came about as a result of a planet twice the mass of Mars colliding with the Earth at a low velocity, and the debris from that collision forming the moon. And so on that basis that people have concluded the moon is probably unique in the universe, because the probability of that event happening anywhere else is very close to zero. And therefore, we're not expecting to find a twin of the moon because of the extraordinary way in which it happened. And by the way, that would only happen if you actually have this planet twice the mass of Mars sharing the orbit of the Earth. That's how you get the low-velocity collision. And what we learn in celestial mechanics is that if you've got a planet orbiting a star, if you go 60 degrees back along the orbit or forward along the orbit, you've got a Lagrange point, where another planet can share the same orbit. However, in the case of the solar system, that would not be stable over a long term. With a planet twice the mass of Mars, it's simply a matter of time before the gravity of Jupiter will jiggle it a little bit. And when that happens, it starts to creep along the orbit of the Earth, and it's that very slow creep that gives us that low-velocity collision that's necessary to give you a moon. If you've got a high-velocity collision, you don't get a moon. You only get it with a low-velocity collision. And it takes that low-velocity collision, by the way, to transfer all the heavy element material from the planet that's twice the size of Mars into the interior of the Earth. And that's critical for life. Without that transfer of heavy element material, you're not going to set up the energy mechanism that will produce the plate tectonics that will give you the continents. Because it was that transfer of heavy elements that super enriched the core of the Earth with uranium and thorium. And so radioactive decay of that uranium and thorium that drives the eddies in the mantle, which again drives the plate tectonic activity, which builds the continents so that you can have advanced life. Now, there's a question in the back here. Yes?
I'm wondering what happened to that planet that's twice the size of the Earth that had the collision with us.
Okay, the planet that was twice the size of Mars that collided with us, almost all of its mass was absorbed into the interior of the Earth. In other words, before the collision event, the Earth was a little bit smaller than Venus. So Venus was the largest of the terrestrial planets before this collision event. But because of the collision event, Earth got elevated to a higher mass than that of Venus. And what was really taking place is because it was a low collision into a very deep ocean that the Earth had at that time, at a high attack angle, that all the heavy stuff in the collider got sucked into the interior of the Earth, and all the light stuff got blasted into a debris cloud around the Moon. And it's that debris cloud that coalesced into the Moon, which explains why the Moon has a lighter composition than the Earth, because it was the result of that collision event. So because of the nature of the collision, there is a separation of the light and heavy element material. And the dynamics was such that that heavy element stuff mainly got sucked into the interior of the Earth, which is exactly what you need to set up a strong magnetic field that protects you from radiation. You know, next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for that one Gauss magnetic field that surrounds the Earth. Because of that one Gauss magnetic field that is stable over billions of years, we don't get killed by cosmic radiation and solar radiation. The Van Allen belts really protect advanced life here on planet Earth. Maybe it's not crucial for certain bacteria, but certainly anything bigger than, say, a centimeter across is going to need that kind of protection. And without that collision event, we wouldn't have that protection. So, yeah, go ahead.
I think I saw on two comments, please. I think I saw on the web that either in the UK or the EU, they are very proud of their telescope-based search for extraterrestrial planets along with the Kepler.
Correct.
And my other comment is I'm constantly amazed at what I perceive to be a great confusion between science and the belief of naturalism. And they're not the same. And naturalism doesn't seem to feel they need an explanation for origins of the laws of physics or of life or of anything. Then they're looking. They think that if you know, they grasp at straws. If we find another planet with bacterial life, I mean, there's no God. It just seems like such a stretch to me.
Well, it's something that I think is well explained in the Bible. The Bible tells us that God gave us the record of nature as a revelation of who He is and what He has done. But keep in mind, science is not the same as the record of nature. Science is our interpretation of the record of nature. And, you know, this is something we talked about at the Astronomy Club on Friday, is that as scientists, we don't know everything. Our knowledge of the record of nature is incomplete, and as you pointed out, there are biases. you know, our human interpretation and the biases about the way we live that gets in the way. And this is something that Paul speaks about in Romans 1, how people look at the creation, and instead of giving credit to the Creator, they give credit to the creation itself. So you'll read people who have a naturalistic perspective or follow the religion of scientism, they'll say, isn't it amazing what nature has done? Isn't it amazing what these little molecules have been able to do all by themselves without any external help? And in one sense, you know, as I work with scientists, there's a certain religious perspective in that all of us who work in science have a sense of awe of what we look at. I mean, take astronomy, for example. You're looking at those 200 billion galaxies out there. You look at the galaxies that are up close. You can't fail but not to be impressed by just what's out there. And I remember when I was working at Caltech, I would take some of my fellow astronomers who were atheists up into the high Sierras, because we had a telescope that was right in the Owens Valley. So we would finish an observing run, and then we would go up into the high Sierras. And what I noticed was these atheist astrophysicists would be out there in an alpine meadow, and they'd be utterly in awe at the beauty of the place. But then again, they would conclude, isn't it amazing the beauty that nature has revealed to us? They gave credit to, you know, the grasses out there and the birds and the trees, the ice and the water, and not to the one that put it all there in the first place. So that's just the way it is when people react to the authority of God over their lives. If you don't want someone telling you how to run your life, then you're going to be motivated to put credit where credit is not due. And so, you know, as we talked about here in the class, you know, if you're going to run into these kinds of folks, you can ask them the question, oh, wait a minute, you're saying something non-personal, non-living, non-spiritual gave rise to that which is living and spiritual and non-physical. And how can the non-physical create that which is spiritual? How can the non-living create that which is living? The problem here is that you're attributing a greater effect to a lesser cause. And that violates the principle that we've been using throughout science for hundreds of years. Science is based on the principle of cause and effect, where effects must always be lesser than the causes. And the problem with the naturalistic worldview, to put it in one sentence, is they violate the principle of cause and effect. So, but again, it's natural. You'd expect the natural man to transfer credit away from God to the record of nature. I've been told I've only got 5 or 6 minutes left.
Two things. You have 8 minutes left, and then B, obviously, over the last couple of weeks, I've had 3 or 4 people come to me and say, you put this slide up, I'd love to learn something about Neanderthal.
Yeah, we're going to get to Neanderthal. That's why I stuck it up here. That was kind of a signal to all of you, give me some time to make some progress here.
If you could put your hands down and if we could learn a little bit about this topic.
And you know, I was going to give you a scriptural context for this, but let me just jump into this because I'm worried we're not going to get through it.
Well, who Neanderthal is? We are.
Well, I know a lot of wives here might think their husbands are like Neanderthal-like, but anyway, who is Neanderthal? And yeah, there was a time, I remember when I was an undergraduate student, I was taught that Neanderthals are humans. And we look at the bones of Neanderthals, they're identical to humans, they're anatomically identical to us. Well, that's been thoroughly refuted over the past couple of decades. And part of it was through the discovery of DNA from Neanderthals. And by the way, we've always had DNA from Neanderthals, but new technology allows us to recover DNA from Neanderthals in which we can actually get a faithful record of what the DNA sample is like. Now, when I say faithful, it's about 67% reliable. And so the problem with DNA is it decays very quickly if you've got water or if you've got bacteria or oxygen in the environment. So what they try to do is find Neanderthal bones that have been buried where they've been cut off from the bacteria, the oxygen, and the water, and then try to pull the DNA out. And, you know, given that we're looking at several tens of thousands of years minimum, you get quite a bit of decay in the DNA, and even under the best of circumstances. But thanks to new technology, they now have mitochondrial DNA from 20 different specimens. And if you're not familiar with that, That's the DNA that we get from our mothers. We only get it from our mothers. The father makes no contribution. And the wonderful thing about that is it allows you to trace the history of a particular species through the female line. The problem, however, is each of us gets about 500 sets of this mitochondrial DNA. The nuclear DNA, you get two. The mitochondrial DNA, you get much more. But what they've been able to do in looking at these 20 different specimens of Neanderthal skeletons is they know, first of all, they can't measure any significant evolution in the DNA. And this is disturbing to the evolutionary model because, after all, these creatures have been here from about 150,000 years ago to somewhere between 40 and 50,000 years ago. If you're going to claim that the human species is a product of natural descent from bipedal primates that preceded us, then you must be able to see significant change in the DNA over a period of about 50 to 100,000 years. In the case of these Neanderthal specimens, that's been refuted. We don't see that evolution. The DNA seems to be static. And also, when we compare the DNA with human DNA, it's about 99% similar to human DNA. But that 1% difference is sufficient that it's now been recognized this must be a distinct species that in no way played a role in the descent down to human beings. And so because of this discovery, Neanderthals are now labeled as a side branch of human evolution by those who believe in the evolutionary model. And so Neanderthal has now been discounted as an ancestor, which means nobody here can say that their son or their husband is a Neanderthal. This DNA evidence has ruled that out completely. The other thing is when we look at the skeletons of the DNA or the these Neanderthals in some detail, we now realize they're not anatomically identical to human beings. They're distinct from human beings. We notice that they're much heavier than us.
Can you show us a skeleton in your finger about showing us the difference between how they look?
Well, I don't have any public domain images I can use. And that's one of the things I try to do with this class because, you know, they've got laws that get you into a whole lot of trouble if you use an image that's not public domain. But there's about 100 skeletons of Neanderthals that have been uncovered. So that's kind of the total database of Neanderthals. And none of the skeletons are complete. But several of them are a lot better than the Lucy find, which is about 35% complete. So we have the best. Of all the bipedal primates that precede human beings, Neanderthals are where you got the best skeletal evidence.
Yeah, I was at the Neander Valley years ago when I went to Germany. It's about 40 miles from Frankfurt. And that's where they found the first fossils. They were digging for a mine or some quarry. And they have a museum there.
There's a museum there, right.
And they have the Neanderthals, dummies, just how they lived right by the river there with tents and everything and shed their weapons and show what they ate and all that. Now, you look at that and you say, these are people,
Well, Al, keep in mind that those little figurines they have in Neanderthals, that's basically an artist's guess. They're not showing you the actual bones.
They found the bones there.
Yeah, they got the bones there. Here, I'll tell you the irony. It was a discovery of the first Neanderthal fossil in the Neander Valley that launched Charles Darwin to publish his book, Descent of Man. And his belief was that that fossil had proven that we were naturally descended from bipedal primates that preceded us. The irony is that very same skeleton was where they got the first mitochondrial DNA analysis. And that very first DNA, it was published about 12 years ago, demonstrated that the thing that launched Charles Darwin's book, Descent of Man, indeed proved that it wasn't an ancestor of the human species because the DNA was so radically different. So that's kind of a historical background there. Here's this first Neanderthal fossil that convinced Charles Darwin that we must be descended from these bipedal primates, and now they got Neanderthal evidence from that very same specimen that proves the opposite. But let me review some of the distinct morphology. They were bigger than we are in terms of body mass, but their arms and legs were considerably shorter than ours. And they're a lot rounder than we are. Their rib cage was a lot more bulged out than our rib cage. And as I mentioned last week, those are characteristics you'd want to have if you're living in a relatively cold climate. And that's where we find the Neanderthals, Europe and southern Siberia. By the way, they never made it into northern Europe or northern Siberia. It's basically lower and central Europe and Siberia. And we find their bones most frequently in caves, which is where you want to go where it's cold. But they had the ideal body shape for a bipedal primate for dealing with a cold climate. And they particularly were blessed with a huge nasal capacity, which allowed them to breathe in cold air without searing or damaging their lungs. In fact, a number of anatomists have noted that the nasal capacity of the Neanderthal is so extremely large, it doesn't fit into any evolutionary tree. Not for the bipedal primates, not for any other mammal line. No mammal has such an enormous nasal capacity. And so they noted that as a challenge to the entire evolutionary paradigm for mammals. How can you possibly explain that huge nasal capacity? On the other hand, if God is wanting to design this species to live in a cold climate, that's exactly what you expect God to do. The other thing we notice is that the hole that takes the spinal column has a very different shape than for the human. I think for the human it's circular, and for the Neanderthal it's an ellipse, very elliptical. Okay, I've run out of time, but next week I want to look at Homo erectus, because the new paradigm is this. Okay, we know Neanderthal is not an argument for an evolutionary paradigm, but maybe what happened is we're descended from Homo erectus. And so they're claiming that Homo erectus gave rise independently to both Neanderthals and humans, that we both split off from Homo erectus. Now, in the case of Homo erectus, it's so ancient, namely 200,000 to 1.8 million years ago, that we don't have any reliable DNA. So the DNA we get from these creatures is useless to tell us anything about them. They're just simply too far back in time. So we don't have any DNA. But what I'm going to talk about is how different their morphology is from both Neanderthals and humans. So the morphology itself eliminates Homo erectus as a candidate for giving rise to both Neanderthals and to human beings. And we'll talk about the evolution of these things. But I think it's going to be most exciting. Given that we see almost a dozen different species of bipedal primates, why would God create these creatures? And we're going to look at the reason why God would do this. There's a very good reason as to why God would create all these different species and why he put them in the different places. For example, we're going to discover why God would want to put a bipedal primate in Europe and Siberia. Instead of just keeping them all in Africa and southern Asia, he had a very good reason to stick one in that area. So we'll discover that next time we get together next week. No, it's nothing to do with mistakes. It's that God knew the state of the future human species and carefully prepared the environment for the human species and wanted to make sure that Europe and Siberia weren't left out. So, because that's the whole thing. Neanderthal just doesn't fit any evolutionary explanation. Wrong geography, wrong time, wrong structure. But from a biblical perspective, it makes perfect sense why God would want to create Neanderthals and put them where he did, and the time and the place that he did. That's the subject for next week. Let me bow for prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the fact that we live in a day and an age when we have so much knowledge about all these recently created species that you made. And thank you, Lord, for giving us insights that gives us an appreciation of why you made them and how they benefit us personally. Thank you, Lord, as we look at the entire record of nature of the past 3.8 billion years, we increasingly see that every species of life you created fulfills some distinct role in serving the human species. Thank you, Lord, for doing all this for us. Lord, what a great and awesome God you are. What a caring and loving God you are, that you would go to all that creative effort in order to provide us with such a wonderful environment to fulfill the purposes that you've given us here in our lives here on earth. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen.
show.